Amen. Luke has been called the Gospel of Amazement. And that's because up to this point, and only six chapters behind us, and starting a seventh one tonight, we've seen multiple episodes of people amazed. Giving a few examples. So Zechariah's neighbors are amazed at the news of Zechariah, who had no children with his wife Elizabeth, and they are going to bear a son. The shepherds in Luke chapter 2 are amazed. Those who heard the shepherds are amazed. In Joseph and Mary's case, they bring the boy Jesus to the temple, and there is amazement. Those who hear the adult Jesus in synagogues in Nazareth and Capernaum in Luke 4 and 5, there is amazement. In Luke 5, Peter and his fishing partners have an incredible catch of fish, and there is amazement. In Luke 5, Jesus heals a paralytic, and there is amazement. Over and over again in these chapters, a reasonable response to the workings of God among the people is to simply be awestruck and to marvel at what is happening. That is appropriate when you consider that in the prophets like Isaiah and Jeremiah, there was foretold a coming day when the kind of joy and jubilation, celebration and awe that God would provoke from his people by this new covenant, the inauguration of his kingdom, and the establishment of the Son of David, there would be a crescendo, to use Mr. Senior's word, of not just his word, but you know, a crescendo and a climax of glorious joy and celebration, right? And when you read Luke's gospel, you're getting the sense that what they were anticipating in the Old Testament has actually arrived, and now we're seeing that kind of celebration, marveling, and awe. That's going to happen again tonight. Significantly, it will be Jesus who does the marveling. It will be Jesus who expresses amazement at something that takes place. There is a miracle in this story, but I must insist to you, the miracle is not even the main part. The miracle sets up what turns out to be a greater focus in the story, the faith and humility of this Roman centurion. That gets more attention. The miracle, there's a need for it expressed at the beginning, and there's a small report at the end that it's happened. But the main character, besides Jesus, if you will, is not the ill person. The main character, other than Jesus, is actually the centurion who expresses such faith. He is aware of Jesus' power to heal. And I think that's recognized in chapter 6:19, where crowds come to him and power goes out to heal people. Jesus has been garnering a reputation as healing diseases and working wonders. We're not surprised that someone like a Roman centurion would get wind of what this man can do. And so rather than being concerned with the miracle itself, the faith of the centurion gets center stage. Verses 1 and 2 give us this ill servant, and this is still setting up the story. So he says in verses 1 and 2, the narrator Luke, that after Jesus had finished all his sayings in the hearing of the people. What sayings? Well, Luke 6, starting in around verse 20, is a series of teachings with the disciples as a primary audience, and then larger, maybe expanding concentric circles of crowds and followers around him. Those are at least an example of the sayings he's been pronouncing. And now, when he's finished those, he enters Capernaum. And he's been there before. In fact, he's been at the synagogue in Capernaum before. In Luke chapter 4, we see that he goes into a synagogue in verse 31. And on the Sabbath day, he begins to teach. And a demon-possessed man encounters Jesus in the synagogue. He also goes to Simon Peter's house, which is in Capernaum, and he heals Simon's mother-in-law, who has a fever. And the many others who found out where Jesus was and what he had done brought all of their sick and their demon-possessed to Jesus, and he works wonders there too. Capernaum has been a place of miracles. You would expect that word would get around. And anyone who hadn't even gone to that house where miracles had been done would have heard. And where does Jesus go now but back to Capernaum? And you can imagine the hype, you know, people perhaps thinking, well, I didn't see him before, but if he comes back, I'm going to go to Jesus. Or I know so-and-so, and if I hear that Jesus is in the area, I'm going to take someone to Jesus. Or I have a need, and I know that this man, if he comes back, he can help me. I know what he's done for others. Jesus has that reputation that precedes him now when he goes back to Capernaum. And in verse 2, the centurion enters the picture. We're told that he's a centurion with no name here. He's just given that title. And this is a man in the Roman army who would be commanding 100 men. Centurion and century, we could think of a figure of 100. And so this centurion, sometimes it was more than 100, but that was the typical group. And so this Roman centurion has a servant. That was not unusual at all. In fact, there are some suggestions in tradition outside the Bible, I mean, Roman traditions and other documents that suggest that maybe Romans did not have close families while they were in service, and so a slave in their home could, in some cases, be the only family they had in their household. And this centurion has a servant, and this servant is sick. We don't know how old the servant is. We don't know the servant's name. We're told here that the servant is at the point of death, and in Matthew chapter 8, we're told in a parallel account that he's been paralyzed, this servant. And we don't know what's rendered the paralysis, but it's not left him in a neutral state of health. This servant has continued to decline, and Luke gives us insight here that he's at the point of death. Luke would be the kind of person to make this statement accurately. Luke is a doctor. And so in Luke's account, he's able to recognize that not only is Matthew correct regarding a state of paralysis, but this is a state of decline unto death. And this servant is valued by the soldier, by the centurion. Our reading ears should perk up at that for a moment, that a slave would be valued by a Roman soldier. That's unusual. What is it about this centurion? He's not the typical centurion. Slaves were terribly mistreated in the Roman Empire. They could be abused. They could be killed. They could be assaulted. It was a very difficult life to be a slave of Roman soldiers in the general sense. This, therefore, should stand out to us that a servant is highly valued by this Roman centurion. And you wonder, well, okay, wait, is it just a practical thing? You know, is this just pragmatics? He has a useful servant in the home. He doesn't want anything to happen to it because he's going to have to afford another one. Well, it turns out that if we're wondering if something is different about this centurion, that's going to be confirmed by the later verses. So we're going to have reason later in the story to say, truly, something is different about this man. This Roman commander would be the sort of person that would surprise readers of the gospel, and no doubt is one of the reasons the story is recorded. We could conclude, I think, then, this Roman centurion is a Gentile, and so the main character other than Jesus in this story is a Gentile being featured. We have to pay attention to that. That's going to matter, I think, for Matthew's account as well. This centurion servant is sick and at the point of death, and we don't know any more details about what is ailing the person. Now, in verses 3 through 5, the request for healing is given, and we know that in Matthew's gospel, the middleman is dropped out, and it just seems as if the centurion is directly speaking to Jesus. Luke's gospel helps us see that the centurion's communicating through an intermediary. The centurion hears about Jesus and in verse 3 sent elders of the Jews. He's employing some people to be, and I don't mean financially paying them, I just mean he's calling on them to do him this favor. And we see why the Jews would be willing to do this in a moment, but the centurion knows that Jesus is there in Capernaum, sends some intermediaries with this request, asking him to come and heal his servants. And so in verse 3, we have a possible issue of ritual defilement that could take place. The centurion is a Gentile, and if Jesus, as a Jewish teacher, enters a Gentile home, well, that question would be, would he then be defiled? And Jesus is willing to push boundaries of what others might consider. Don't do that, Jesus, that's going to defile you. And he ends up not being defiled, like touching the dead or touching a leper or the woman with the issue of blood. There have been a number of stories in the Gospels that actually Jesus doesn't become unclean. And yet, to those who are sensitive to those social boundaries, it would have been a concern. And so the centurion sends these elders of the Jews who are asking Jesus to come and heal his servants. Now, we don't know the nature of the centurion's request, but here's what the Jews will then say. They come to Jesus and plead with him earnestly. And in verse 4, they speak about their centurion associate, and they say, "He is worthy to have you do this for him." He is worthy. They're wanting Jesus to not have any reluctance here. So if Jesus has this spectrum of people that he does miracles for, there's people who are unworthy of such miracles, and so he doesn't do that for them. And then there are people who are worthy, and Jesus would give them that attention. Then the elders of the Jews say, "Jesus, this centurion is on the worthy side. He's somebody worth your time and worth your attention. He's worthy to have you do this for him." Because of what the centurion will say later on, it seems that this is coming from them originally, this language about you need to, in a way, do what would be owed given his status. This is something that ought to happen. Look at who he is and what he's done. So here's what he's done. They're going to cite some merits, as you might call them, merits for why Jesus should attend to this guy. Verse 5, "For he loves our nation." So that's reason number one. And then reason number two, "And he is the one who built us our synagogue." The elders of the Jews would no doubt represent other Jews as well who feel favorably toward this centurion. So reason number one, he loves our nation. Not every Roman centurion might have heart of sympathy and care toward the Jewish people, all right? When he says, "Hey, Jesus," when they say, "Jesus, you're obviously a Jew," he loves the Jews. So this is not like some enemy of the Jews, Jesus. He loves our nation. And while they are under the political oppression of the Roman Empire, something's different about this centurion, and they want Jesus to really attend to that notion. Secondly, one of the ways he's shown his care for the Jews, his sympathy among the people, is that he built us our synagogue. And that's probably the one Jesus was in earlier in Luke 4 when he encountered a demon-possessed man. Now, there would be reasons why you would want to be in the good graces of the Jews. The Romans wanted to have peace in their realm and in their place of rule. So befriending Jews, any segments of Jews, especially people associated with the temple or synagogues, that was in your best interest because it advanced the larger political goals of the Roman Empire. But it tells us here, he is the one who built us our synagogue, and this suggests that this Roman centurion was a kind of patron or benefactor that helped these Jews in what would be very important to them in their religious practices on the Sabbath day, meeting in a synagogue. Now, we don't know if he just built it in the sense of improvement, whether this was something from the ground up that was his innovation. But either way, when the Jews hear from this guy, "Hey, will you go to Jesus?" Their response is, "Of course we will. You love us, and look what you've done for us. The only reasonable thing, given what you've done, is that someone do something for you." So Jesus, he's worthy of you to do this miracle. I think this is their way of saying, "Jesus, if anybody deserves this, this guy deserves this. He loves our nation. He built us our synagogue." So Jesus goes. Verses 6 through 9, the centurion's faith and humility. It tells us Jesus went with them, and I think we should see this as Luke preparing an entrance into a Gentile's house. That's where the servant is. He's paralyzed and near death. I know in Luke 5, some people were taking their paralyzed friend who wasn't at the point of death and lowering through a roof. That's not this situation. This is a situation where Jesus is probably going to have to enter this man's house. And Jesus is prepared to do so. He's already dined with tax collectors and sinners earlier in Luke 5. And so if even though some political or social leaders and influencers might frown upon Jesus' behavior, Jesus is not going to be conducting himself in a way that he will become unclean and in violation of the law in that sense. So he's going with them. And I think we should understand this to mean he has every intent to go and heal this servant. But this is not to imply Jesus says, oh, well, clearly, you know, I was going to pass on this until you told me what this guy's done. You know, loves your nation, built you a synagogue, so I'm going to stop going this direction and I'm going to head to this house. Clearly, he is merited. This is not to suggest Jesus has the same calculus that they do. In fact, I think we're going to see that the centurion doesn't even evaluate this the same way they do. So in verse 6, when he's not far from the home, apparently the centurion gets word, and he sends friends to Jesus. Earlier elders of the Jews, and now some friends to Jesus. Lord. Lord. And listen, because of what he's going to say of Jesus' authority, this is not just a polite address. You could sometimes speak of someone as a Lord in a lowercase L way. It's a polite form of address in the ancient world. That's not, I think, the mindset of this centurion when you see these verses unfold. He believes that Jesus is superior. He believes that Jesus is great. And as a man with surpassing authority. And so when Jesus sees these friends from the centurion approach and they're meeting him and he's almost at the house and these friends say, wait a second, we have a message from the centurion. And the first thing he's got to say to you is, Lord, and then this, do not trouble yourself. For I am not worthy to have you come under my roof. We are meant as readers to see that play on words that earlier the elders of the Jews are saying, hey, you need to go because he is worthy. And the centurion is saying, I'm not worthy. And that's an important correction because this is not about a miracle because of merit. This is not a display of Jesus' power because here this guy just happens to deserve it more than other Roman soldiers or other ailing people in Capernaum. Lord, do not trouble yourself, for I'm not worthy to have you come under my roof. You might wonder, is the centurion thinking about that clean, unclean boundary? Perhaps. I don't think we can eliminate that entirely. He may be thinking, well, you're a Jewish teacher and you have great authority, and I don't want you to defile yourself coming into my house. I'm not worthy of that kind of breach. But the language about worthiness and what he's about to say about Jesus' authority, notice that the centurion didn't even come to Jesus directly. He's going to say in verse 7, therefore, I did not even presume to come to you. And by the way, that would have meant leaving the dwelling of the Gentile. So I don't think it's so simply explained that, hey, the reason the centurion says I'm not worthy is he didn't want a Jewish teacher to come under his roof. The centurion didn't seem to think it was necessary at all to have Jesus in direct contact. That's the point. And he doesn't feel worthy of Jesus even approaching him, knowing the authority Jesus possesses. It has reminded New Testament scholars of John the Baptist, who said, there's one coming after me of whose sandals I am unworthy to untie. That John the Baptist had an instinct and an insight prophetically about Jesus, where he believed that Jesus was great and not just a great teacher, but far surpassing him in authority and status. That's the kind of echo I think we should hear in Luke 7. Something that this centurion believes, it's not just politeness, it's not just clean, unclean boundaries with Jew-Gentile dwellings. This centurion believes, you are a man of such status and authority. I'm not even worthy of you to come to my house. You shouldn't even trouble yourself. In fact, your authority is so great, here's what I believe you can do. So I'm not worthy of you to come under my roof. Therefore, in verse 7, I didn't presume to come to you. We see the feeling of unworthiness not only with John the Baptist earlier in Luke 3, but even Peter in Luke 5. There's a boat, a miraculous catch of fish, and when Peter sees the abundance of fish and the nets are about to break, Peter sees it in Luke 5:8 and says, depart from me, Lord, I'm a sinful man. What is Peter sensing in the presence of someone so great and so powerful? Peter senses his unworthiness. And now here's a Gentile in Luke 7 sensing his unworthiness. If people have ears to hear and eyes to see in these stories in Luke's Gospels, what the Jews with eyes to see and the Gentiles with eyes to see will realize is in the presence of someone so great sent from God, what is our right response? We're unworthy. That's John the Baptist's take, and that's Peter's understanding, and I think the centurion, we don't know his name, I wish we did. We'll meet him in glory, but this guy is unworthy and he knows it. It's not like he can use to dangle in front of Jesus what the elders thought. He built our synagogue. He loves our nation. Here in verse 7, he says, "Therefore, I didn't presume to come to you." I want you to notice how humble this is. This is a centurion. If he said to his men, "Drop and give me 50, you know why they've got to do that? Because of who he is. And he answers to other authorities. And he would follow that line and chain of command because of who he is and whose authority he is under. He knows what the function of authority is like. He's an impressive figure. He's a man of money. He's built the synagogue. He's in good graces with the nation. He has things on his resume, in other words, that he could use to get his will done. But not with Jesus. Not with Jesus. Whatever was impressive to anybody else is not impressive to Jesus. And it's really good news that Jesus is not impressed with any of us. There's nothing about us that Jesus is just impressed by. Some accolade, some merit, something that we've accomplished. This man here, all that he's done, and whatever authority and status he held with others, he is unworthy before Jesus. And that's the right perspective. Because in comparison to Jesus, what else can we be when we rightly understand his greatness and supremacy, but see ourselves as unworthy of his power and work in our lives? Which means that when Jesus does, it's not a matter of merit, it's all mercy. That's the right M word. It's not merit. It's sheer mercy, which stimulates greater praise and glory to God. If it was all about merit, when God does what we would deserve, if that's the kind of thing that Luke 7 would be talking about, then it's simply we receiving what we are owed. And in this case, larger gospel truth notwithstanding as well, mercy is what's on display. So he says, therefore, in verse 7, I didn't presume to even come to you, but say the word and let my servant be healed. Now, I want you to see why that's different from the previous miracles. Because these demon-possessed people that are brought to Jesus in Luke 4 in Capernaum, they're there in his presence. Same thing within the synagogue in Luke 4. When the nets begin to break with the fish in Luke 5, Jesus is in the boat. Jesus goes to Peter's mother-in-law in Luke chapter 4 and heals her. In Luke chapter 5, he touches the leper. In Luke chapter 5, he's dining with the tax collectors and the sinners after doing wonders and calling people and summoning disciples. People are used to seeing in their very face the display of Jesus' authority. But here's what this centurion suspects. This centurion suspects this man's authority is so great, he could simply say the word, and like a God would, his word will be done. Not even in the, you know, it's one thing for Jesus to do something in somebody's presence and maybe someone nearby say, was that some kind of sleight of hand? Was that some kind of, you know, manipulation visibly, some illusion, some clever trick? Not what you see in Luke 7, it couldn't have been. This is a ramping up, if you will, of a display of power where, and not even could you write off previous miracles as sleights of hand considering what's displayed. So just to be clear, that's not what I'm implying could be the case. He's just saying here, I so understand the authority that you have, Jesus. You need only say the word. Just say the word and let my servant be healed. And I think we should feel the echoes of things like Genesis 1, where God speaks. And when he speaks, His authority over all things is expressed where dominion is exercised. And this centurion, you know, I'm not saying he's got all of his Christology worked out. I'm not saying he understands the two natures of Christ. I'm not saying he's got all of this kind of understanding. I'm saying what he does know, he knows truly. He's got a lot more to understand. He's got a lot more to learn and grow. But what he discerns about Jesus is true. And that is the greatness and authority of Christ and the centurion's confidence in that. So he explains more about his confidence. He says in verse 8, "For I, too, am a man set under authority with soldiers under me." And I think the following comparison is this. The centurion is saying, I can give instructions and my word gets done. And Jesus, I believe you can act out of your authority and things happen. So the examples he gives in verse 8, he says, I say to one, go, and he goes. And to another, come, and he comes. And to my servant, do this, and he does it. This message from the centurion, we've seen worked out in Jesus' own authority where he says to the leper, be clean. And the leper is clean. He overcomes the fever and the demons in Luke 7 in the very next story. Not even death itself will resist the word and power of Jesus. Luke 7 is continuing to make the larger case that Jesus is coming with an unprecedented authority, a supremacy with his words and deeds, of which there is no accurate match prior. It is such a clustering and surpassing greatness that Jesus embodies that this centurion believes something incredible. That Jesus, you don't even have to be in front of my sick servant. You don't even have to be at my house. If my request would come to you, you need only speak wherever you are, and then wherever the ailment is, that will be rectified. That's an incredible display of confidence, and that's what Jesus responds to. Verse 9. When Jesus heard these things, he was amazed, or he marveled at him. This further shows us the gospel of amazement, which the book of Luke has examples already that we saw near the beginning of the sermon. When Jesus heard these things, he marveled at him, marveling at the centurion whose message was sent. And then we find in verse 9, Jesus is not like alone with his disciples. There's a crowd. And just like the crowds earlier in Luke's gospel have seen Jesus do miracles, they were saying, well, we're not missing this. We're going to follow you to this guy's house. And so this crowd is going with Jesus, ready to see this sick servant restored to full health. And Jesus turns to this crowd, and here's what he says next. I tell you, not even in Israel have I found such faith. So the camera zooms out, right? And all of a sudden you realize this whole crowd has been with Jesus. And this is the climax of the story. And I know the healing's important. I don't want to diminish that. But the main feature in this story has been the incredible display of faith and humility from this centurion. The elders of the Jews had said, Jesus, he's worthy of it. And the centurion says, no, I'm not. It's not a matter of unworthiness. I just know that you can, and you don't even have to be with me. You can just speak and it would happen. Jesus says, I tell you, not even in Israel have I found such faith. And I think that simply means as Jesus has gone throughout the promised land teaching, no one has expressed that kind of explicit confidence in those terms like this man did, and he's a Gentile. Whoa. Here's an understanding of the Son of God who's come into their midst to inaugurate the kingdom. And this Jesus says these words about a Gentile. That's really good news because Jesus has come for the Jews and Gentiles. And I think we could consider this guy's faith a foreshadowing like Abraham. Earlier in Genesis, before there were Israelites in Exodus. Abraham, the father of a man like this, father of a centurion who demonstrates that faith. So what's unique about the centurion's faith is the scope of authority that he believes Jesus' power has. A vastness, an immediacy, something that's not even limited by distance. What is this? What sort of man is this? Jesus says, I tell you, not even in Israel have I found such faith. Now, at the end of the story in verse 10, it does finish off what we began with the report of an ill servant. In verse 10, when those who had been sent returned to the house, now, first of all, they would no doubt give these words from Jesus to the man. That would have been good news to share. But they found the servant well. So even if they thought, my goodness, you know, Jesus isn't going to come after all. The centurion has expressed such faith. But I wonder if any of those friends thought, crazy guy, if he'd have only brought his friend to Jesus. Or why didn't he just let Jesus come? And they show back up, and then lo and behold, that servant is well. That servant has been healed. In other words, they get to bear eyewitness testimony that what that centurion believed about Jesus' authority is true. They saw it with their own eyes. One writer put it this way: while the earlier Jewish elders commended the centurion's deeds, Jesus commended the centurion's faith. And that's a big distinction. And that's a good and healthy distinction, because it's not about merit or deservedness. This story has the Jewish elders commending his works, his deeds, and Jesus highlights the man's faith, which was more important than the fact that he built a synagogue or that he had good graces with the Jews. Some New Testament scholars have heard echoes from an Old Testament story, a pattern of sorts. And you may be familiar with the story of Naaman in 2 Kings chapter 5. Who was a Gentile in need of something. And there was some intercessory work also in 2 Kings 5. Naaman does not actually meet the prophet Elisha. And the healing takes place at a distance, not in front of Elisha the prophet. Naaman has to go and he's dipping himself, right? And so you have in 2 Kings 5 what might be a callback that Luke 7 is making to this powerful prophetic ministry. And now here's one even greater than Elisha, greater authority and greater embodiment of truth and word than even Elisha himself exhibited in the Old Testament. Now, I've referenced a couple times that this story is not only in Luke. Matthew's gospel has it also. And in Matthew 8, I want you to hear what Matthew also includes with Jesus' statement. Matthew 8:10 does tell us about the man's faith Jesus commends. So that's no different here. But I want you to listen to what comes next. I tell you, Jesus says, with no one in Israel have I found such faith. All right, so that's the same thing in Luke 7. I tell you, and here's what's added, Matthew 8, verses 10 through 12. Many will come from east and west and recline at table with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven, while the sons of the kingdom will be thrown into the outer darkness, and in that place there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Now, that inclusion in Matthew's account is important because we're reminded that this Gentile who believes will be like many who come from east and west. In other words, who are not part of the land of Israel. They're Gentiles. The ingathering of the Gentiles in the kingdom of the Son of God is foreshadowed by a man like this. So I tell you why this story is really good news. We're Gentiles, and here's a man who believes in the greatness of Christ. And we can be encouraged because we want to have this kind of faith, and no doubt faith filled in with a lot more teaching and revelation and understanding from who Christ is in the Gospels. But we understand and can rejoice in this centurion's heart. We can see that not only did he care for his servant, not only did he see himself unworthy of being in the presence of the miracle-working Christ, he believed that the greatness and authority of Christ was of such a scope and extent that Christ could simply speak and his will would be done. Jesus has come to minister to unworthy Gentiles. That's why that's good news for us. That's really good news, because it seems that the only requirement for this miracle is that the man be unworthy of it. And if Jesus comes to work among those who are unworthy of his power and mercy, well, then we have a safe place for faith, don't we? We have a firm resting ground, because we would all look upon ourselves and say, Christ is nothing to be impressed with us. All the worldly accolades and accomplishments and whatever else we can hold before others and other realms where we might exercise this or that, before Christ, we are people of need. And he is a God of great mercy. And that's our hope, is that this God works not according to our merit, but because he loves us and he is merciful. And here this compassionate Christ was on his way to do that very thing. So Jesus has come for unworthy Gentiles. And what's good too is this centurion doesn't have to come in direct contact with Jesus physically. Aren't we in such a very similar situation where we have not encountered the physical Christ? And in 1 Peter chapter 1, I want you to be encouraged with these words, because Peter says in 1 Peter 1:9, though you have not seen him, you love him. Not only are we like the centurion who had not come into contact with Jesus in this miracle, but nonetheless had faith in him, we have faith and love the Jesus we have not seen. Peter says, though you do not now see him, you believe in him. Yes, we do, though we have not encountered him physically. And you rejoice with joy that is inexpressible and filled with glory, obtaining the outcome of your faith, the salvation of your souls. So this means here is a guy where there is distance, and now we experience this with heaven and earth, where Christ is enthroned at the right hand of God, and yet nonetheless, his will is being done by his power and through his servants and in building his church and exercising power through the gospel and the preached word as it is faithfully done. If you are encouraged and strengthened, and even in the hearing of the word tonight, that is the mercy of Christ at work in our midst. And though not bodily present, though we cannot see him, we love him and we believe in him, and he will bring to pass the outcome of our faith, and that is the salvation of our souls. We recognize, like the centurion, we are unworthy, but that's never been a condition for God to act in terms of worth and merit. In fact, unworthiness is where Jesus does his most profound and merciful work. And so when we think of ourselves unworthy of the mercy and love of God, well then, all right, we are in line with these gospel stories which recognize a compassionate and merciful Savior. And when we receive the merciful work of God, we can thank the Lord that it was never because of merit. And out of thanksgiving and glory to God, we can live our days knowing that that mercy, though undeserved, was something that in God's love and compassion was poured upon us bountifully and even in Christ everlastingly in the age to come. We have not seen him, yet we love him. We have not seen him, and yet we believe in him and rejoice, Peter says, with joy. Let's pray together.